Hello out there, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Vince, you're wearing a nice colorful t-shirt there with the thumbs up, very, very optimistic, very up.
I appreciate it, yeah. Nice reference to Fallout that I got at a very nice price at a thrift store.
There you go. It's always...
I never said I was a man of means.
But you are a man of taste.
Oh, well, I appreciate it.
End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Thursday at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new biopic, I, Tonya. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items that have been making the rounds, including the reevaluation of the work of Woody Allen. A.O. Scott, the prominent New York Times movie reviewer, wrote down his own considerations in a post, and we'll talk about those and maybe our own considerations about Woody Allen. And everyone's getting excited about the release of Black Panther. Well, almost everyone, but we might touch on that. But are we forgetting the first big black superhero, which is Wesley Snipes as Blade? I think we are kind of forgetting him, but we're going to talk about that too. And then we're going to kick things off, though, with a modern twist. This is concerns Richard Roper, who, I don't know, maybe some of you kids out there might not know. I remember when he took over for Gene Siskel as the co-host of Roger Ebert's At the Movies. And he's a reviewer for the Chicago Sun-Times. He was suspended for buying Twitter followers. And for you older listeners, yes, you can buy Twitter followers, apparently.
Astounding.
For you even older listeners, Twitter is a social media I'm just kidding.
Wait, I gotta write this down.
We appeal to all listeners here, but he was buying Twitter followers, and that's a legitimate business somehow, although Twitter apparently discourages the practice.
So he's been suspended by the paper. Newspaper that he writes for.
Correct. Well, okay. He was suspended. His suspension was lifted over the weekend.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Okay,
he has officially been unsuspended.
Right.
But, I mean, it's not without consequence, though, because apparently he was going to start a new, like, kind of lifestyle column or something that he's not going to be able to do now. And he has to delete his Twitter account and rebuild it from scratch, which is the ultimate slap in the face in the modern era. It's you know, it's not where you want to be, starting again from scratch on Twitter.
Yeah. You know it's bad when the president still has his Twitter account and you have to get suspended for that.
It's so true.
Why? I actually only remember Richard Roper from the show. I was too young to really remember it when it was Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. Richard Roper never really like appealed to me as a viewer. I never really connected with his like views on movies. And I think that was part of the reason why they paired him up with Roger. They had some good kind of conflict there. But the issue for me isn't really whether Richard Roper did this. It was like, is this actually morally incorrect in some way, or is this wrong? I don't really care about what Richard Roper is doing anymore, but. When I first read the article, initial impression was like, yeah, this is kind of wrong. And it's also kind of counterintuitive, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Counterintuitive against or to the whole purpose of Twitter, which is that if you are interested in me and what I have to say, then you will seek me out and you will follow me. So what is the logic, or what is the purpose, rather, of accumulating followers as if they were, you know, whatever?
Well, I think the purpose is the appearance, right? Where if you're someone with a lot of followers, or it looks like you have a lot of followers, then people will say to themselves, I wonder why this person has a lot of followers, right?
Right.
Because I think it gets to the point where you sort of plateau and the thing starts to take care of itself, because if it's popping up in people's feeds, and this happens to me all the time when I'm on Twitter and I see somebody I know retweet someone interesting, and then I will look up that person, maybe I will follow them. Mm-hmm. So if that's happening, sort of in the Twitter wilderness, aided by these bots, And of course, Twitter has its own bots too. They have like the promoted tweets and all that. It's, you know, it makes things that much easier. And it's not even necessarily malicious either.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are bots, like, when I tweet at city council meetings, I'll tweet like, now we're going to talk about the review of the urban design manual. And then I will get a couple of like random retweets from like things I've never heard of. But they're bots who are on the lookout for tweets regarding like urban design, let's say.
Okay.
So it's a little microcosm out there. That's,
yeah,
know.
maybe I'm just so out of the loop. Maybe I'm just so I can't empathize with that problem like at all, like just needing to have people like follow me or whatever. The whole thing just strikes me as absurd, and the fact that they suspended him, I'm erring on the side of like I think they were in the right for doing that. I think it's kind of a sleazy thing to do. Maybe not something that that a paper like that one would want their reviewer to do.
Right.
Which I can understand.
I mean, no matter who you are, it's ethically, morally dubious to inflate your own sense of self.
Right.
But I would understand why someone like Steve Mnuchin's wife, the Treasury Secretary's wife, when she was an actress, you might want to appear to be more popular than you are without the help of bots, because a lot of casting is done on the basis of influence. Are you someone who a lot of people are going to be interested in seeing cast a movie? You're like, hey, I'm casting this movie. That's fine. But Roper himself admitted that he did it to build his brand. Now, it's the point of being a newspaper columnist, even if you're like a movie reviewer or a pop culture commentator, it's the purpose of writing in a newspaper to build your own personal brand.
Correct. Yeah. No, yeah. It's not. Or is it to review movies?
Right. Because, I mean, it's a bit different for like if you and I were to buy bots like to follow end credits, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This is our brand.
Yeah, spoiler alert. I just did yesterday.
But this is our brand. But, you know, Roper is part of this mechanism called the Chicago Sun-Times, which I think is under the Tronc umbrella. So the Sun-Times has its brand. Tronc has its brand. Is it, you know, necessary for Richard Roper to be able to use these platforms to then foster his own brand and then on top of it all buy Twitter robots to inflate that further? You know, are you part of a machine? Or are you using the machine? Are you stealing parts from that machine in order to build your own machine?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, then I got to the comments, and people mm-hmm. were kind of. I was shocked at how many people were. Well, not shocked, but it did surprise me how many people were completely against what my initial reaction was. They
right.
were like, "Well, it's coming out of his own pocket," you know. Presidents, politicians, whatever, do this all the time. Who really cares? And it just seemed like people just didn't really care about that kind of behavior. And again, maybe it's because I'm so out of the loop, but it just seems incredibly sleazy to me.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, the rumor is, too, that half of Donald Trump's own Twitter followers are bots and fake accounts from companies like The Vernie, which is the name of
right.
the company.
And I don't endorse any like politician or whoever doing that either. So
right.
it's like, I don't. Mm. But it is interesting, the line that people will draw. This is okay up to a certain point, but this is not okay. And I think this is like, it just tiptoes like under the line. This is okay. You know what I mean? It's bad, but it's okay. We're not willing to like rake Roper over the coals for this.
Well, it's not like he expensed it, which I think would right. have been really outside the bounds if he was like, you know, this is an expense in order to, you know, to do the business of movie reviewing. I think that would, that would go in another direction. So I appreciate the point. I appreciate that, you know, it's probably a different climate depending on, you know, what age you are and how mm-hmm. Meshed inside the social media bubble is. But, you know, there are people out there who are trying to do good work and, are kind of leaning on like the process of discovery.
Yeah.
Instead
yeah,
of like
point.
The process
yeah.
of inflating their own self sense of worth, trying to essentially buy their way into notoriety. I discovered this great YouTube sort of essayist named Lindsay Ellis. She does a lot about movies and pop culture, and she is so great, and she has a Patreon, and you know, this is someone I would support. And you know, it'd be sort of disappointing to me if, you know, there are to find out that, you know, she's buying bots, and it'd be disappointing to me if I found out we were buying bots. And like you joked about, you know.
Yeah, but it's like, is it something that is enough to kind of, you know, make a fuss out of?
That's fair. I think if he was in any other business but the newspaper business,
would,
or, you know, politicians, again, it was revealed that some politicians have done it, a lot of athletes, a lot of movie stars. But because he's a journalist in the newspaper business, it makes it, I mean, that's kind of like the bottom, maybe not the bottom rung, but sort of the top rung. There's a rung to these things. You want to understand, again, why movie stars would do it, or why, you know, people trying to influence things, influencers, and the people do it. Because, you know, your revenue is sort of dependent on the appearance of you being an influencer and being popular. Being successful in the newspaper business is not dependent on you being popular. And in fact, a lot of newspaper people tell you it's quite the opposite.
Yes.
If you are extraordinarily unpopular, you are excellent at your job because everybody hates you. Mm-hmm. So, and there's must be a reason why everybody hates you. And some of those might be legitimate. And the two are almost opposite in intense, but
Yeah.
Okay, good talk.
Yeah, good talk. Richard Roper, yeah. Thumbs down. Yeah. Don't sue me.
We almost made it through this segment without the... Oh, right. My. Anyway.
You can edit out any copyright infringements. I'm sorry.
This show is well known for editing out infringements. Anyway.
Let me just say that if Jake Lloyd was here, okay, Anakin Skywalker, I would have to ask him, you know, about the Force, or I would have to make a Force joke. So that was my obvious...
I hear he's available.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, A.O. Scott, who is speaking of film reviewers, this was unintentional, by the way, but he wrote a piece about, you know, trying to wrap his mind around Woody Allen, of course. There have been, it's interesting in sort of the Me Too movement to come back to Woody Allen, who has been in like the sketchy area,
yes,
shall we say,
yeah,
of this for years, because he... married the adopted daughter of his ex, Mia Farrow, who he had known since from a child. They got married when he was 21, or when she was 21, I should say.
And he was significantly
older. And, I mean, stood the test of time. It's been almost 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But, knock wood, Woody Allen. But, of course, we've had allegations come out since by Dylan Farrow, who was the biological daughter of Mia Farrow, alleges that Woody Allen molested her when she was a child. Her brother Dylan, who's a newspaper reporter himself, has been very, actually has been one of the people who broke the Harvey Weinstein story. So, you know, people are taking another look at Woody Allen, and we talked on the show a couple of weeks ago about people who are like sort of disassociating themselves, whether that's Rebecca Hall or Greta Gerwig. And
there's like a momentum that's kind of
very slow momentum,
building against him,
but it was interesting to come at it from the film reviewer perspective, because A.O. Scott related was that he has a very long serving artistic relationship with Woody Allen. He's been a fan for years, and now he's trying to sort of rectify, can, you know, you reasonably go back and watch something like Manhattan or Annie Hall or Hannah and Her Sisters and separate out.
So it wasn't really an essay that was trying to prove a point. It was more his kind of introspective, maybe, take on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was more of like he was an extremely influential cinematic figure, as you said, and now I have to kind of, you know, rewatch everything with a different eye.
Well, and that's what he was advocating for, because, you know, the immediate visceral reaction to anything is like, well, I can't watch any Kevin Spacey movie again.
Right,
I can't watch any, you know, Harvey Weinstein. Of course, last weekend Uma Thurman finally told her story, and it was an incredibly dark and depressing story about what happened on the set of Kill Bill involving Quentin Tarantino and maybe his meanness and complicity in everything. And the point A.O. Scott's trying to make is like, well, maybe the point isn't to turn off and not watch those things. Maybe the point is to sort of watch with a new eye. And he lists several examples of places where you can read some of Woody Allen's personal demons into the text of his films. And one of his points, too, is that Woody Allen as an artist is at this like weird cross section of sort of like navel gazing, you know, comedic culture. And I think the way he phrased it in the article was like it's halfway between like all the psychoanalytical stuff that came around like the 70s. And then also halfway to like our selfie obsessed culture that Woody Allen kind of has that corner covered. And so it's almost irresponsible to not look at what he's done and where culture is through that lens, and that his movies may inform that too.
His story is particularly troubling for me because it's, and I have to be careful with this, but it's like, where do you draw the line between what is just creepy to you and what is actually objectively, maybe wrong is the wrong word, but illegal.
Unorthodox. I would
say. Yeah. Yeah. And he never struck me as, he always struck me as more on the creepy side as opposed to the actually illegal. Maybe I'm missing something. I don't know.
Well, him and I can't remember the Sunyan, her name is.
Yeah, yeah.
They got together when she was legally adult. Mm-hmm. And of course, he knew her from a child, so that's very icky from that perspective that you watch someone grow up and go, okay, now I love you as a romantic partner.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's always been kind of, it's something that sort of is in the back of your mind for those of us who are old enough, the last couple of decades, that has been a thing that happened.
Because he is portraying these very kind of normal kind of blue-collar relationships between people, you know what I mean?
Right.
And meanwhile, he's got this kind of unorthodox, as you said, thing. Right. So it's hard to not see that. But he also strikes me as someone that kind of shuns what society as like a larger kind of culture would accept or disapprove of. He strikes me as someone that says, yeah, society might see this as wrong, but you know, I myself am kind of an outsider, so it just kind of fits in with my character now.
Yeah, Scott had a line where it's like about how Woody Allen's movies, how he turned a scrawny, bookish, self-conscious nebbish into a player.
Yes.
Which, if there's a romantic thesis, it's like this guy who is nothing we would normally consider the masculine ideal in terms of a romantic partner is, you know, always with a beautiful woman who is, you know, as smart, if not smarter than him, and who's, you know, cultural and outgoing and all these wonderful things. Someone who probably...
There's always someone else vying for his kind of love as well.
Exactly. And it's someone who in real life probably wouldn't have given someone like Woody Allen a different look. But it was also reflected as real life. Like when he was dating Diane Keaton, Diane Keaton was in all his movies, and he was dating Mia Farrow. Mia Farrow was in all his movies. So he kind of crosses this bizarre line where life imitates art, imitates life. Mm-hmm. It's this bizarre mirror.
I don't know. I've always had this, I've always been on the side of trying to appreciate the art as opposed to, I'm not somebody that watches Braveheart and is kind of conjured up with all of these, you know, Mel Gibson's history or whatever.
Right.
But A.O. Scott now, I mean, from what I got from the article, seems to think that that's impossible. You can't like separate it now. Anybody that can is like, well, you know, on some other kind of playing fields or whatever. But I don't know. It's always been relatively easy for me. I don't know.
Well, Woody Allen's a unique case too, because he's like writes and directs and stars
yes,
many of his movies. Kevin Spacey, it was more often than not a gun for hire, where he is, you know, was hired for his acting skill. So maybe that's a bit harder or a bit easier to sort of forgive. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to go back and watch and not rewatch Usual Suspects or
American Beauty or
American Beauty.
Might
I
be
feel
bizarre.
Like it's,
yeah.
I feel like it's out of, yeah, it's bizarre, but yeah. I feel like American Beauty is also maybe out of its time now.
Now that I'm thinking about it, yeah, it is.
But I mean, that was also Scott's point too. It's like, can we watch these things and read into, you know, what appealed to these men in these parts? The other thing he brought up is, oh, now I can't remember the other thing he brought up, but I did want to make the point that, I don't even remember. Anyway, let's move on. I'll come back to it. I'm sure we will definitely come back to it at some point. So speaking of cultural moments, we've got Black Panther coming out in a couple of weeks, and we kind of talked about people's excitement on that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an article in the Washington Post, I believe it was the Washington Post, about like, whoa, not so fast with like the first big black superhero thing. There was this thing called Blade, and it starred Wesley Snipes, who was once upon a time this huge action star, and he was starring in this comic book movie in a time when comic book movies were not cool.
Mm-hmm.
And he came along and sort of like radically, I mean, he didn't do it alone. There was, you know, a director and a writer and a producer and a co-stars involved. But, I mean, he sort of lent credence, because he was a well-known action star at the time, to this new approach to comic book movies, which was to take the material seriously and to, take the material seriously, because people may not know that the Blade in the movies was not the Blade who was in the original comic books.
Right.
He wasn't a daywalker in the comic book. He has since become a daywalker.
Right.
They've sort of retconned that or added to his backstory or something or other, but there was a significant departure. So it wasn't a literal translation, but it was a serious translation. And I think we have forgotten that. I'm glad the Washington Post made this point.
I do think it's a bit of a stretch to compare the two, though, to say that,
sure,
whoa, we had something that was, you know, equivalent to what is happening now back in the 90s. It's like, yeah, but now with the kind of the trend of all of these big, almost like just astoundingly big superhero movies for the last...
It's an industry, you know, now.
Yeah, and you know, you've got this trend of, you know, hiring these very kind of young, talented, very promising filmmakers to take on these big budget things as well. Ryan Coogler obviously did some very nice like independent work before all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more to that story, I feel, than just superhero versus superhero.
Right, but I think the point that the author was trying to make was that Black Panther hasn't happened in a void, and indeed he made reference to Spawn, which was Michael J. White, and
right,
of course Spawn in the comics was also a black hero. Spawn was at the time probably the biggest hero in Image Comics, sold, you know, millions and millions of copies, made Todd McFarlane rich. And then you had Shaq in Steel, which, I mean, both these movies were not successful, and not successful in even the sense that Blade was.
So it's not the scale that he's really comparing.
Right.
It's just the concept of
right,
there was a big kind of thing.
Right.
I understand that. I don't know if he was implying that, you know, that kind of set off this trend, which I think is also maybe a bit of a stretch as well, that as a result of Blade, you know, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man came from that, and then Blade 2, which was, you know, this enormous kind of budget, or the budget was inflated significantly higher.
That was the one thing I disagreed, where he said that that Blade 2 had more life and verve than practically anything about MCU. But it's like,
and
yeah,
it's definitely a Guillermo del Toro. I don't know about that, but
well, it's I think it's a more of a Guillermo del Toro movie than it is a Blade movie.
Yeah,
when you
true.
Look at the first Blade.
Just in the sense that there are these kind of creatures and this mythology around the creatures and stuff like that.
Right. It's very monster relatable. Mm-hmm. It's very, because, you know, it's not just like all these vampires are evil. There are some good vampires, there are some bad vampires, there right. are vampires who are just jerks, and it was a very interesting direction to take following the first Blade. Where I think it all falls apart, though, of course, is Blade Trinity.
Yes,
and of yeah. course that is the third Blade. It was a bomb.
Which the article was like, we're not even going to go there.
We're not even going to. But it was. I think they should have gone there because, if there's a reason why Blade isn't more well thought of in sort of the legacy of where comic movies are now, it's because that thing tanked, and it was and if you believe Patton Oswalt. Mm-hmm. Who appeared in that movie, a lot of it was like self-destructive because of Wesley Snipes and the toxic relationship between him and David Goyer, who directed it, and how Wesley Snipes would not respond to Goyer, and basically Wesley Snipes would come out and do close-ups and then that would be it, and which is why every reaction shot in Blade Trinity is him like staring at someone who just said something, and there's really no
right.
There's no dialogue or animus at all in the character. It's just, of course, at that point, Snipes was dealing with bigger issues.
Financial problems. Yeah. But it's like you said, he was a big action star, you know what I mean? And that Blade struck me as like Wesley Snipes, another kind of action vehicle where he
right.
happens to play this as okay. opposed to Black Panther, where there's these kind of this depth and this really kind of elaborate script and the kind of history behind everything, just seemed different to me. But
there's a very explicit subtext to Black Panther, and plus there's the very, you're right. It was Blade was just another action movie, and I thought like we're gonna get Wesley Snipes is gonna make like $50 million. We're gonna
even
make our money.
Even the special effects were pretty brutal. End, yeah. And now, of course, special effects is like,
of course, Steven Dorff
have...
got equal billing too. It's worth knowing.
Oh yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's there's an elaborate mechanism behind Black Panther too. Mm-hmm. The character was introduced in one Marvel movie, and he's being followed up in another Marvel movie, and then he appears in another Marvel movie later this year. But I think it's worth noting there's context, because I think, as we mentioned in the Wonder Woman review back in episode one, that
back when Steven Dorff was still, getting top billing.
But no, back when Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman wasn't the first big female superhero. I mean, there was movies like Elektra, and there was, something like The Hunger Games even. The Hunger Games could almost very easily be called superhero movies with the Jennifer Lawrence character and her bow and arrow fighting, intractable foes.
So what was it that
weapons.
Wonder Woman was so iconic as
right.
a character being brought to the screen, or because
right.
this culture that's kind of demanding more strong female characters and more kind of female-driven stories is what
yeah.
made it.
It's all of it, and I think that's where we're at too with Black Panther.
Yeah.
It's cultural. The culture has been primed for this.
So it might not be breaking new ground, but it is a new kind of culture, maybe.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the last time we agree on the show. No. Because we are reviewing I, Tonya, and we were talking over the show. And
spoiler Vince's... alert, I liked Blade Trinity. No, kidding. I'm kidding.
Don't go there.
I take that back, yeah.
But it's on record now. But we're going to talk about I, Tonya coming up. And before that, we're going to skate away with the Dire Straits. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Down a wrong way street, for all the world like an urban toreador. I share wheels on and feet. When the cars do the usual dances, same old cruise in the curbside crawl. But the roller girl, she's taking chances. You just love to see her take them all. No fear, alone at night, she's sailing through the crowd. Enemies, his bones are tight and the music's playing loud. Hallelujah, here she comes, Queen Rollerball. And enchanté, can I say, care I all. You know, she used to have to wait around. She used to be the lonely one. But now that she can skate around town, she's the only, only one. No fear, alone at night, she's sailing through the crowd. In her ears, his bones are tight and the music's playing loud. She gets rock and roll in a rock and roll station. Rockin' old dream. She's making movies on location. She don't know what it means. And the music make her wanna be the story. And the story was what.
Did you, I mean, when I was a kid, did you ever love me or anything?
You think Sonia Henny's mother loved her? Poor f***ing you. I didn't stay home making apple brown Bettys. No, I made you a champion. Knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes. I wish I'd had a mother like me instead of nice. Nice gets you s***. I didn't like my mother either. So what? I f***ing gave you a gift.
You cursed me. Monster.
Spilled milk, baby.
That's going to be fun editing later. That was a clip from I, Tonya. It is the new film by Greg Gillespie, and it stars Margot Robbie, Sebastian Stan, Julianna Nicholson, and Allison Janney there with the potty mouth. So, we were saying before the break that I had some issues with it. You love the film, so I will let
had some issues.
Well, I think you're more hyped about it than I am, so you go first.
Yeah, well, I thought this was a great film. I had a lot of fun at this movie, and you know, I was, the Tonya Harding thing exists in my mind the way that the O.J. Simpson thing kind of existed, in the sense that the notoriety of them came from this one kind of incident in an otherwise relatively respectful sports career or athletic career. So it was very interesting to kind of get into a deep kind of character study about this. And I was very, very moved by how she kind of grinded her way, Tonya Harding, I mean. And the performance by Margot Robbie, I thought was just like fantastic. I had kind of perhaps shamefully labeled or thought of Margot Robbie as a certain type of actress. And movies like this really helped to kind of reshape my impression of those kind of people. It was a great performance. But you really see that she was not a woman of a lot of means or wealth growing right. up. It was her and her kind of domineering mother trying to... to just as I said, grinding through this thing that both of them kind of were banking all of their hopes and all of their ambitions on.
Right.
And
there's a surprising classism to figure, or maybe not so surprising classism to figure
skating. It is, yeah. And there is this strange kind of facade that I think you have to put on when you're, or at least the impression that I got.
Right.
Of figure skating, which is that you have to have the look and the character, even if you're not that character. She was really participating in a sport, basically, that did not want her. mm-hmm. kind of shunned her. It saw her as a redneck, as a kind of, you know, hillbilly. And she spent an enormous amount of energy and time trying to prove herself as, you know, the art, the talent and the sport is really what matters, and yeah. not necessarily my character or my upbringing, but
right.
the sport never really reciprocated that. It you know, did everything, at least from what I got from the movie, to kind of hold her back, basically.
Yeah, and if you know anything about figure skating, it's like for years it's dirty as sin with allegations of cheating and,
oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
bribes
yeah.
and things. Yeah, that stuff I found very, very informative. That's probably one of my favorite parts of the movie, is like the class warfare angle of this and how it ended up informing, you know, what happened, what they call in the movie
the incident. Yes.
with Nancy Kerrigan, because Nancy Kerrigan, of course, was all that. She was the ice princess type, and sports, it by and large, has become largely about the stories. And so every hero kind of has to have a villain. How many sports rivalries are there? So mm-hmm. this kind of thing was already being conflated in as a rivalry between two skaters. We never really see them interact in the film, Nancy Kerrigan
right,
and Tonya
yeah.
Harding. It's kind of implied that they were friends or friendly and maybe hung out together. But it never really deals with that. And, of course, that plays into one of the whole angles of the film about who's telling the truth about what and all that. But a lot of this came from the outside, though, was, you know, it played into a lot of these stereotypes. It's like, you know, Tonya Harding came from working class background. Nancy Kerrigan came from a upper class background. Nancy Kerrigan was a brunette. Tonya Harding was a blonde. You know, you can read into all these various rivalries all mm-hmm. you want. And then it explodes with, you know, a couple of dingbat decisions from, you know, from guys who...
A couple of dingbat people.
Yes. And that was another thing that I found kind of sort of very informing about the movie. This guy, this character, Sean, and the actor who played him, Paul Walter Hauser, just a delusion on display. Like, oh, I'm like an expert in counterterrorism tactics. And it's like, no, you live in your mom's basement and hang out at the ice rink with your other loser friend. It's, you know, we see that a lot these days, where people who have like absolutely zero expertise at all, but maybe watch enough YouTube videos to think that they can replicate expertise.
Yeah.
And I found that very... That had some interesting parallels to
yeah.
the way I felt. But.
And Jeff Galluli I knew like nothing about
yeah.
at all,
right.
Except for, you know, his affiliation with that incident, as they say.
Yeah.
yeah, man, that guy was like a very strange, kind of insecure, very pathetic kind of character. He
Galluli or the other guy?
Galluli. Okay. I mean, the whole crew, Galluli's crew was, but especially Galluli, yeah. Himself was very, I mean, it sets up their relationship. They met at, you know, while she was practicing one day, and the relationship was kind of conflicted, but they maintained this, it's almost this Martin Scorsese type relationship where they keep coming
yeah.
back to each other and
right.
then fighting and breaking it off.
They're horrible for each other, but they can't stop being together.
Yeah, and then Tonya Harding's, as her career kind of progressed, I think she kind of demanded more of her partner.
Right.
And that's where some of the conflict, he started beating her more,
mm-hmm.
I would say, it seemed to me, out of a deep insecurity that she was going to be successful and more kind of important and not need him. And in a classic kind of way, he, you know, had to beat her into submission to keep her around.
You know what's weird about that is I feel like the domestic abuse is almost played for laughs in most of the movie.
Really? Okay.
That I feel like it's, and there are allegations it went both ways, but I feel like it was kind of meant to be like a honeymooners kind of like to the moon Alice kind of a thing, and not like, I don't know if that's the way it was meant to be played, but I certainly feel like that we were on the edge of a chuckle every time he would he would do something, because it'd be like something over like Dove bars, how she likes Dove bars instead of Eskimo pies.
Right, yeah.
Instead of it being what you said, which is about his insecurities, like, oh, she wants Dove bars now. Eskimo pie isn't good enough for the great Olympian, Tonya right. Harding. I didn't really fully appreciate it. There was the scene where they're coming from the lawyer, they're meeting the lawyer, and they get in the truck, and she starts saying, talking about, you know, how what they should do, and he just hits her. And I think that's the only scene where with the abuse that I feel like really lands with the shock. And I'm not sure why. It's, you know, because we've seen them, you know, go at each other through the whole movie, and this is getting close to the end. And but I think that's why. It's like that's almost like the first instance where the film takes the abuse explicitly seriously, because it's now a serious situation where they're all likely to go to prison,
right?
Rather than just being like this charming quirk in the relationship that, you know, they hit each other and yell at each other.
Yeah, fair. I felt like they were I felt like the movie was trying to maintain a tone. So
right.
Like the whole case is just so absurd. It's like you've got these morons trying to pull off this thing, you know.
Moron,
and it's like
right, yeah.
there's just something absurd about them trying to break a woman's legs in figure skating that I feel like to play it super serious, to put a serious dramatic tone on this film would have lessened it. So they had to kind of make it this,
yeah,
you know, black comedy almost. So it's like,
I don't disagree. And there's a great line when the police arrest the two guys, and they're like, how did you find us? And the cop says, and I'm like, well, next time don't use your Visa card when you're committing crimes.
You know, I didn't catch that line. Yeah. Actually, but that's what it was. Okay.
Yeah,
fair enough. Yeah,
it's kind of yeah, I mean, that part is hilarious, but I think, you know, dealing with their relationship, I guess it would have been whitewashing it if they hadn't dealt with it at all. But I feel like that's where the black comedy doesn't land, because black comedy is a tricky type rope to walk
right.
in the first place. But I feel like that's where it has a struggle. But I find it works in other places, because we're, you know, talking about the perception of her and the white trash, and then her becoming a punchline after this too. It's a reminder to me that, you know, the 90s were this period where, you know, there were a lot of sort of these women who were sort of caught up in these scandals, like people like Amy Fisher, people like Lorena Bobbitt, mm-hmm. Even Monica Lewinsky, who, yeah. like, these women became pariahs, became villains, became, you know, everything, you know, that men's rights people hate about women.
Right,
you know, that... You know, behind every woman is someone who wants to cut your manhood off,
right,
or you know, gets you into trouble, you know, or seduces you, and it's like a seductress that ruins your life. It's, and the film does a really good job of saying, Tonya Harding became a punchline, but we're going to show you what maybe she could have been by focusing on, here is a woman who had technical excellence, but had to overcome so much that had absolutely nothing to do with the skating.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things is just, you know, her, I mean, one of the things that kind of led to this, why she was, you know, in the orbit of Gahooly constantly, is because he did at least show occasional affection for her when he wasn't hitting her or yelling at her. And this is someone who I think would really wanted to be have affection shown to her and be loved and get that kind of encouragement, which is why she goes back to her original coach, Diane, who's, you know, this lovely, positive influence, and well played by Julianna Nicholson, too. I thought mm-hmm. she did a great job.
Yeah. And, you know, you can... That's what I loved about the movie, is that there were so many... there were so many aspects that it explored of her character
mm-hmm.
and of the whole situation, you know what I mean? Just the idea that you have this child who's, you know, extremely gifted at, how do you nurture that? Well, in her, you know, in the mother's eyes, it's like the world is full of competition.
Yeah.
And you have to rise above that competition, as opposed to, hey, here's an activity that you could enjoy and be passionate about and express with, you know, love and pride.
Yeah, and Lavanya kind of, who's the Tonya Harding's mother, Lavanya Harding, mm-hmm. kind of bullies her way into getting Tonya involved. Like, hey, my kid is excellent. You should train my kid. And the coach is like, well, I don't train kids that young. And she's like, well, you're going to train her. And then she's like, orders Tonya to go out and show them what you got. And then, you know, there is that line that they do show in the trailer where Lavanya's on the sidelines yelling at Tonya, like, don't talk to that girl. She's mm-hmm. your enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't talk to the enemy.
Yeah. It all it struck me as was that she was never figure skating out of passion.
Right.
It was never coming from her soul. You know what I mean? It was always this win or loss. Did I get the gold medal or did I lose? It was always this very black and white activity that I think was brought on by the pressure that her mother exerted on her.
And what's interesting is, like, later on after the incident, she's talking about how she came in eighth and had to walk around with a smile and be glad that she finished so well. Meanwhile, Nancy Kerrigan gets the silver and has, I can't remember the exact expression she used, but has a look on her face that she
stepped in poo.
Yeah, that's right. She came in second, won the silver medal, and she looked like she stepped in poo, which is, you know, again, a great sort of rhetorical indication of again, the classism in the sport. You know, second is the first loser if you're Nancy Kerrigan. Meanwhile, if you're eighth, you have to be super proud of yourself if you're Tonya Harding, given your limitations and your background.
Yeah.
So that part of the film I found really, really persuasive. What I did not find persuasive is Allison Janney.
Really?
I don't get it. She's getting all this awards consideration, but I don't get it.
I think it's very hard to see the performance when someone is so ruthless and so unlikable in some ways.
That's true.
So I think she played it so well that, in my opinion, that it's almost kind of, it seems flat. It seems like she's one note.
Yes, it does. I think if they wanted Lavanya Harding to look like a cartoonish supervillain, Allison Janney nailed it. But there are a lot of people doing cartoony supervillain things, and I'm not sure why this rises above.
If everyone in the film was kind of like, I feel, an exaggerated, you know what I mean? Jeff Galluli was portrayed as this, like, really dumb, and you know, the other guy, Sean, mm-hmm. they were all kind of these, I don't know, these Coen brother kind of characters. It's like nobody was portrayed exactly, you know what I mean, the way that they probably were.
But I feel there was a depth to those guys, because even Sean, like, Sean's this, like, deluded mess of a person who he kind of desperately wants to be somebody, and so he figures out a way to mold his friend's life into making his life justifiable by becoming Tonya Harding's bodyguard and hatching this plan.
And there's definitely some, like, ego issues there, how he actually thought that he was in control. He's like, well, I'm the one that, like, you know, is executing this plan. Like, I'm actually in control.
I'm thinking four steps ahead.
Meanwhile, the FBI is, like, 2 seconds away from catching you. It's like, but with that being said, I think Allison Janney had a lot of character depth, too. It was just later in the film that you saw it. Like, that scene the clip that we just played. Mm-hmm. You know, through the whole film, she just kind of berates and puts down Tonya Harding. And then, you have that kind of significant discussion where she goes, here was my perspective the whole time. I wasn't nice to you because, you know, I felt like that would have made you an inferior figure skater. I felt like that whole scene really gave her the depth that
I know what you're trying to say, but I don't feel like there was depth there. I think there was kind of like a self-awareness about, you know, it's like one of those movies where the hero confronts the villain and is like, why did you do this? And the villain's like, well, I'm a bad guy, so I have to do bad things. And I feel like I was putting you in figure skating, so I had to ride you hard and be a monster in order to make you the best person you could be, which I think is a cop-out because I think she was just a jerk.
Yeah, but she was a jerk with a certain perspective. You know what I mean? She was, I think a jerk would imply that she had no kind of positive goals or aspirations in mind for her.
I don't think she did.
I don't know. I think deep down she wanted that success. It just, she had trouble articulating it. She said, you know, like, she obviously had a very troubled relationship with her mother as well. I think.
Well, she says.
Yes, yes. So she.
We don't have any proof of that. And we know she's kind of someone who can, we see later in the film, she's someone who's more than willing to manipulate a situation.
I think, yeah. I think she was a classic. She was a classic, you know, overbearing parent with a very talented child without the ability to kind of nurture that talent. But jerk? I don't know. Yeah, I guess maybe she was a jerk in some ways, but I think...
I feel like there's no motivation to the jerkiness. It's just like she's just this like horrible train wreck of a person with a myriad of flaws, be they psychological or emotional, and she's taking them out on this girl who kind of needs her talent nurtured, not like have like her mother paying off guys to scream at her in order to get her worked up before a competition.
Yeah, but that to me illustrated the depth of her character, that she thought the only way to motivate her daughter into figure skating, to giving her best performance, was to kind of trick her or to do something sketchy. You know?
I understand that. I don't understand why she would do it, though. Like, what's, like...
She obviously convinced herself that it worked. She
I know, but what does it matter to her? Because it doesn't seem like it matters to her whether Tanya does good or not. You know, it's... She's, yeah, like, being dragged along by the hair to... That wig was horrible, by the way. She's being dragged along to all these things to take care of, you know, Tanya's career. And it seems like she at some point is just resigned to sort of being a passenger in this, like a sort of like a backseat driver in Tanya Harding's life. And there's really kind of no indication why. I think if it was explained, like, or if it was shown in some way, like, I'm hard on you because... somebody, you know, from our family has to make something of themselves, or, you know, we're not going to be white trash. I mean, I don't know if she actually thought any of these things. But the character in the film, you know, I just found over the top in terms of just how much of a jerk she was. And I'm not saying that Allison Janney doesn't do a great job. I'm not sure how this is one of the best performances of the year, and one that is likely to get the Best Supporting Actress Oscar, is my point.
Fair enough.
it's a very good cartoony role, is my, just, you know, it, that's where I'm coming from on this. And I went into this thinking, like, she must be so great in this, and it's like, she's kind of blah. I don't know. She does, you know, when she's dropping F-bombs and you know, swearing at the kid and stuff. Yeah, it's funny, but I mean, that's, there have got to be at least five other people in movies last year who were doing the exact same thing just as well, and I'm not sure what elevates this.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. I've convinced you she's terrible.
She's a terrible human being. I'm not sure the performance was terrible or the way it was written, but I will certainly agree that she was a despicable person.
All right. But you're right about Margot Robbie. Great performance by her. There's a scene where, like, she's trying to get herself pumped up for her Olympic performance, or she's just staring in a mirror and there's just, like, so much going on. And I'll say that also, this is Sebastian Stan's best work too.
Yeah. And
The Winter Soldier.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I would say that if I could go back and redo my top 10, and I can because it's on the internet and you can obviously change anything.
You can change anything on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. I would put this in my top 10. I really enjoyed this.
Okay.
One thing I'm kind of, I feel like is a trend now that's really bothering me is something that they did in The Big Short, which is this idea of breaking the third wall to go, this actually happened, as a kind of wink to the audience, like implying that, yeah, we get that everything in a based on a true story is not actually true, but this actually was true. I don't know. I thought
the whole framing was off, like with the interviews and things.
Yeah,
and had Bobby Cannavale as like the hard copy guy for no reason.
Yeah,
I thought hard copy was going to come into it in some way, but he's just sitting there like cracking wise about it. It's
got these two FBI agents that, okay, I'm not familiar with as actors. It crossed my mind that they might have been the real FBI agents. And then, yeah, there's this Bobby Cannavale, and then you're not even focusing on what he's saying. All you can think about is that goofy like tan and the facial hair. Yeah, yeah, that he's got. It was distracting.
It was. Anyway. Yeah, I guess.
Otherwise, I highly recommend it. I think it's a great character study. I think it's a great study of what, of someone who is more complex than that story led to believe.
Yeah, I would agree for that purpose too. I think there were a lot of great stuff, and I think Margot Robbie was great, and it's worth seeing. I just think it has more flaws than I think we've been led to believe, but. Yeah.
We'll agree to disagree on that.
I didn't agree to that. you can listen to our show again at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also find us at social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on End Credits Radio at the Twitter feeds that Vince doesn't understand. So, Vince, if you're not on Twitter, where can people find you?
I can't buy followers.
You can't buy. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure you want to. But where can people find you on the internet otherwise?
Facebook, Vincent Masson.
There you go. I am on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson and on Instagram at the same. And I will be on, actually, no, that's not true. Open Sources is preempted today for Black History Month coverage, but we are posting a podcast version of the show online at 5 p.m. So just go to the Open Sources webpage at opensourcesguelph.com and then you'll be able to listen to that at 5 p.m. like usual, just not on CFRU because we're preempted.
But you do have Twitter is what you're trying to say.
Yes, I do have Twitter. And Open Sources has Twitter too, at @OS_Guelph. There you go. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we'll be back here next Thursday at 10 a.m. for more end credits. And we'll see you then.